Welcome to the class. We are going to be studying Ruth and Esther in this class, and if you'll look at the schedule of classes, Mason and I are working on this together. I'm going to be taking you through the book of Luke in the next five lessons, including today. And it's going to be really interesting to squeeze that into five lessons, the book of Ruth. So, made the mistake of running a 24-hour relay this weekend with 16 miles of running. And that in and of itself is a mistake, but to do it the day before starting a segment teaching is pretty difficult. I'm feeling a bit hollow, so if I make some of those mistakes, just forgive me and correct me. I'll be taking you through the book of Ruth, and Mason will be taking you through the book of Esther. And you can follow the outline as we go through the class. Just go ahead and shut this. You'll see on the outline that I'm not going to hand out any assignment sheets. Mason may have a plan to do so. But I have referenced one of the class workbooks that was put out on the Embry Hills website by Daniel Grantham. And if you're the type that really wants to work through some worksheets prior to class, you'll find those to be pretty helpful. I think they were structured pretty well. So I point you over to those lessons, and then as we're getting up to our texts, you can prepare the proper lesson in advance. We're not going to go over those worksheets, but I just want you to know that they are there. I do, however, want you to read through the text for the next class on this schedule at least twice. In fact, given how short Ruth and Esther are, you would be greatly blessed if you just read through the book at least once, if not twice, before each class. And I think you'll find that you'll get the most out of taking that type of approach. I want to start with a question this morning. You've probably seen, in fact, I just referred to, this has happened twice in the last 3 years, I guess. Oftentimes when Ruth or Esther is taught, you find them taught together. This is a Ruth-Esther class. Why? Why are those books often put together and studied together as kind of a unit? Yeah? Okay. All right. Books named after women, and prominent people within those books are women. So that's the first thing that perhaps is why a women's training class is sometimes developed around them. There might be a convenience argument as well. Each of those books is relatively small. Ruth being 4 chapters and Esther 10. They're both sort of in a story narrative type of format, so there's kind of some similarities in that regard. But think about the two books. What do you know about them and where they happen in the historical timeline? Do they have any relationship there? All right, the book of Ruth happens when? Chapter 1, verse 1.
Period of the Judges,
which is about roughly, does anyone know, in the period of Bible history?
I've got 1105 to 1098. It's been brought up that it was during the time of Isbah.
Okay.
So I get a little bit more specific for you.
And I have seen it explained. Maybe Ruth, it was during the time of the earliest judges. I've seen Ibzan. I've seen... I haven't seen that one. Shamgar was the third, I think, right? So it is not known exactly when during the time of the judges, but just that time point. I mean, I think about Saul, David, and Solomon is roughly about 1000 BC in the period of judges before that. Call it 1100, 1200, maybe even a little bit before. But, in that period of history during the time of the judges, and you think of all the history that you may know, we'll refer to some of this in a little bit, regarding the time of the judges. Book of Esther happens when?
483 to 474.
Okay. Barry's got the reference Bible.
What Bible are you using, man?
400s roughly. During the period of what? Yeah, okay. In fact, we're even beyond the Babylonians at this point into the Medo-Persian Empire. In the first few verses of the book of Esther, you can see that reference. So, from the standpoint of when these books happen, they're completely disparate periods. Maybe not 1,000 years. quite, but, you know, approaching 1,000 years difference. So kind of their contexts are different, the backgrounds are different, and yet some of the challenges between the books are going to be the same. Mason and I talked, and I think when we got together, that was the first question that was kind of brought up, was why are these books put together? You know, and I just happened to see that a lot of commentaries that you can get out there will split the two or put Ruth with Judges as you would expect, but there's one or two pretty well-known commentaries that could be grabbed out there that put these two books together. You know, why would you do that? And what we talked about is we really want to focus then on some of the comparisons, some of the threads that can be tied between the two books, some of the themes that we think would be really helpful from a practical standpoint for studying together. And one of those themes has to do with, and I'm just going to put single words up here, this word is just stuck in my mind, and it's not necessarily the best word to describe the whole theme that we're talking about, but assimilation. Assimilation. What does that word mean?
In a cultural context, it means you're going from one culture to the other and trying to blend in with that.
Okay, so it's the idea of you've come from one culture and you are moving into a different and another culture, and you can see the simile, right? Similar. The idea that you are going to become similar to those of your target or new culture, right? Does that happen in any way in the Book of Ruth? Who experiences that? And I'm speaking on a broad level. We haven't even studied the book, so if you don't know what happens in Ruth, you don't know the answer to this yet. You'll learn. We'll get into it. But what happens in the Book of Ruth that is an assimilation?
It kind of happens twice in a way. There's two generations. You've got Naomi and her husband, and the children kind of assimilating into Moab.
Okay.
And then when she returns home with Ruth, then now Ruth has to assimilate into the Jewish culture.
Okay.
Israel.
In the first 5 verses of the Book of Ruth, there's kind of a moving out of Israel into another culture and an assimilation that happens. And the question you're confronted with right off the bat, first few verses, is that a good thing? Right? But then, as Ruth comes into the picture and events develop, then there's this, well, we should return, and what's going to happen? Who's going to return? What motivations will they have? Will they bring the Moabite culture with them, or what does it take really to assimilate into the culture of God's people, right? So there's this whole theme of assimilation and the challenges that go with it, where, you know, particularly with Ruth, even though it happens both ways, but we see the challenges of Ruth and, of course, Naomi, you know, re-assimilating in some way, you know, coming into God's people and the challenges that are faced and kind of how that goes. How about the Book of Esther? Is there anything like that there? I mean, we just said this: the Book of Esther happens during what period of time? Are you going to be challenged to assimilate in a period of captivity? Even if your highest leader of the captive nation has policies that sort of work to encourage the different cultures and kind of respecting of them in some ways, still there's strong forces that are going to work on you to assimilate, to kind of put away your old way of thinking from your old culture and join the new, the captive culture that you're in now.
And also, I mean, she has been there, but she has been more like passive, not
okay.
Citizen. I mean, she was just living her life. But then to go from that in this nation to a level of like political intrigue that's swirling around you, the most powerful person. I mean, that is a huge, like, culture shift, even if she had been somewhat used to, like, everyday life.
Sure. So kind of there's this, there's the one thing about assimilating in everyday life, but then there's Esther, who is married to the king all of a sudden, and the challenges that are going to go with that.
So, not to give away too much, but
the sort of foundation of Haman's proposal to the king is these Jews have not assimilated into our culture. They have their own laws, and that's not good. And Mordecai's observation to Esther is, you can't fully assimilate because you would be denying your identity.
Right.
And so you've either got to take a stand, or you can try to hide and be killed.
Right. And in both of these situations, Ruth and Esther, we're talking about kind of the pagan culture versus the culture of what should be God's people, right? And the question of the separation and the joining of the two. Are there going to be practical lessons for us in those ways? Absolutely. And we're going to focus on those as we go through. I would say another theme then would be the providence, the providential work of God. Do we see that in the book of Ruth? And it happened. She found herself in the field of Boaz. I like the way chapter 2 reads in that way. And there are other things there as well. And then you've got, of course, in Esther, you know, it happened. The king couldn't sleep that night. And they were reading the records of what had happened. And, oh, Mordecai has not been rewarded. Well, you know, one of the more famous things known about the book of Esther is that the name of God is not present within the book. Is God present within the book? Yes. And I think we'll have a lot of things to say about this. And then there is the theme, and again, I'm just putting one word up here, but there certainly is this thread of the prominence of women as people that affect great things within the book. And we're going to talk about not just those women, but how others in the book sort of react and respond to them, because that there's both honoring and dishonoring of women that is, I think, important to identify, and I think we're going to learn some really good lessons there. We've also got several other things that we wanted to hit on, some of the other thematic connections regarding the importance of good counsel and being useful in God's kingdom, not requiring a powerful position and things like that. But I think we're going to hit on that as we kind of work through these texts, and we'll draw out the comparisons as we go through. Any questions about that and kind of what we intend to accomplish? Having never sat through a women's training class in Ruth and Esther, I'd be welcoming feedback to say, you know, what kind of things are talked about that maybe I'm not hitting on. That might be good for us all to talk about as we get through as well. More feedback and more response from you, both in class and after class, would be very, very helpful. Let's turn to the book of Ruth, if you haven't already. And we're going to begin reading there. Book of Ruth, we're going to read chapter 1, and today our plan is to go through just the first 5 verses. Talk about some things that we can draw out of there as we set the context for the book. It says, beginning in verse 1, "Now it came to pass, in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. And the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her 2 sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And so the woman survived her 2 sons and her husband." Now, we've already kind of talked about the background of Ruth and the context in which this is happening in the days of the judges. What specifically, though, is going on at this particular point in time, according to verse 1? What challenge? There's a famine going on. In fact, that is identified here in these verses as the motivating factor as to why this family, why Elimelech, makes the decision to gather his family and to move to the land of Moab. You know, the very first question that should pop into your mind is, was that a good move? Right? We've all been there where we're in a situation where a trouble arises and we're grappling with how to deal with it. And we might have a lot of ideas, but not kind of certain what should we do. In the case of Elimelech moving his family, was it a good move? The text doesn't stop to really tell us in detail the answer, so we have to kind of grapple with it. How would you answer that?
Can't start with that. I don't know if it was or it wasn't. You know, decisions like that, sometimes we want to judge them strictly by the success of the decision, and there are a lot of things here that would say, well, maybe it wasn't. You know, they all end up dying except for the women. But a lot of it goes back to his motivation. Why did he do it? Was it a lack of trust that the famine would ease up? Was it, you know, why? If we understood his motivation, I think we'd have a better idea how to judge the success. I mean, I'm sorry, the appropriateness of this.
Well, it's interesting. You said we kind of judge that based on success. Did it succeed? You kind of highlighted that the husband died and then the two sons died, right? Was it a success? Someone might say on reading these verses initially, well, I mean, that could have happened in the land of Israel. It doesn't say they died of hunger. In fact, from the standpoint of did they solve the hunger problem, did it seem to work? We're not given much detail, but it's not like they went, whoops, we made a mistake coming to Moab.
They lived long enough for the boys to grow, you know. Married.
Right.
I don't know how old they were when they moved, but they lived long enough to have wives and be with them for a while. So.
Right. They settled in. In fact, the word at the end of verse 2, as I understand it, is definitely not the word for a sojourner. It's kind of like Abraham being here in a foreign land, maybe temporary, whatever, but it's not exactly the most permanent of settling words as I understand, right? But it does basically say they settled there. From the standpoint of solving the hunger issue, they probably have found at what appears to be a solution. So was that a success? Okay, good highlight. We're going to come back to that in a minute. What? Think about the famine. Where's the famine taking place?
In the land.
What is significant about that? I mean, famines happen in a lot of places. Famines happen today in places. What is significant about a famine happening in Israel? Okay.
Was there something going on with, like, war or fighting going on, and that was where all the resources were going?
Okay.
Were they trying to get out of a war zone?
All right. So there's a lot of questions about the environmental factors, maybe, that was going on right then. What about, you know, I think you can't help but see verse 1, be reminded this happened in the time of the judges. What does that signal to you? You know, what do you learn from the book of Judges? How is it structured? What does it teach?
Well, Israel would fall away or not be following God, and he sends people to bring them back. And he also sends things like famine to get their attention. So.
Okay. You know, Judges, what is that cycle? If you've been in a Judges class before or read through the book, everyone talks about the cycle, the pattern that is repeated over and over again within the book. What is that cycle?
So if you start it with Israel being faithful, then eventually they fall into idolatry and other sinful practices, and God sends something to oppress them, usually a foreign nation of some kind. They cry out to God. Now God sends them a redeemer, a judge, to help them. and everything gets restored to something good, and we're set for the cycle to start all over again.
Okay. So the cycle of when things were going well in Israel versus when they were not depended on the faithfulness of the people. Right? In Judges chapter 2, somewhere within verses 11 through 23, as you put it all together, you see the cycle defined. And I think it's important to see that, you know, when they turned from their faithfulness, right? It says that God brought the calamity, right? Verse 15 of chapter 2 says that, you know, in that part of the cycle, wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity. And then notice the next few words. As the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. Think about that. That cycle, it says that God would bring calamity against them when they turned away from Him and their unfaithfulness, as He had said He would, as He had sworn He would. What does that mean? What's that referring to?
The promises in there, the curse is actually in the law.
Right. Right. So, you know, texts like going back to the book of Leviticus, chapter 26, right? You might want to flip back there and take a quick look. We won't read the whole text, but Leviticus chapter 26. You know, when you come into the land, beginning in verse 3, so the whole chapter makes clear, beginning in verse 3, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then look at verse 4. Then I will give you rain in its season, the land shall yield its produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last till the time of vintage, and the vintage shall last till the time of sowing. You shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land safely. And this coming verses say, as you keep my covenant, you will be blessed with these things. But if you do not obey me, verse 14, and do not observe all these commandments, verse 16, I will do this to you. I will even appoint terror over you, wasting disease and fever, which shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of heart, and you shall sow your seed in vain. Those are like, you can't really mess with those words, right? God's not kind of saying, you know, words that can be taken multiple ways there. It seems pretty clear that God has promised, when I bring you into the land, its fruitfulness, its produce, is not going to be dependent on the environmental factors. You know, the time and chance thing is not going to rule in this land with you. My promise is going to rule. And as long as you are faithful, the land will produce, and when you are not, I will turn against you, and the calamity that God swore, well, Leviticus 26 is it. I don't know how else to read, and somebody can correct me if they see something different. I don't know how else to read the first few verses of Ruth and understand that this famine must be going on in the land of Israel because the people are in that part of the unfaithfulness cycle. Which means what? How should the people be responding to this calamity?
Prayer and repentance.
God, we see the trouble that we're in. We have recognized that, you know, you have told us that these things will happen to us when we are disobedient. God, we repent. Bring us deliverance from this.
So, if I'm jumping ahead,
go ahead.
Forgive me, but these first five verses are setting up an important kind of theme that runs throughout the book, which is this theme of going from nothing to everything, you know, from cursing to blessing in a law kind of way. At the end of the book, you know, Naomi is explicit about the fact that God has accomplished.
Yeah.
And so maybe we should read that as the end of this statement at the beginning, which is if God accomplished the blessing at the end of the book, then God is accomplishing famine at the beginning, the nothingness that the book begins with.
I like that. Naomi recognizes this in some capacity all through the book, right? When you hear her talk, it's like God has brought judgment here. God, she has heard God has visited his people and brought food back to the land. You know, her perspective is clearly set on this idea that God is the one in control. She may not know all the answers of what God is doing, and may even kind of shortchange him a little bit in thinking at times, but she sees that. Contrast that with what we're challenged to see. We are challenged to think just in terms of the environmental, which is how the rest of the culture that we are tempted to assimilate to today looks at things, right? God is the one that is bringing the famine here in these first few verses. The proper response is to identify repentance. Elimelech does what? Okay. I see food there in Moab. I need to spare my family. Is that a good motivation? Sure. I want the best for my family. But his response is to head to Moab. Right? I would argue, you know, the question of was it wrong to leave? You know, it's kind of tempting to think, well, you know, all of Israel needed to corporately repent and that type of thing. Elimelech's just one person. No, I think we're meant to understand he should be a part of the reform, not run, kind of as you say, right? But God intended for his people to dwell within the land, right? When you think of that, was it okay to move to Moab? Well, you're going to see throughout the Bible story different things happening. You know, there'll be questions of why this person is there, that person is there, why this person married whosoever. But the intention of God, as you rewind the tape and look at the history before the book of Ruth, is that the people were to dwell in the land and be one with their God.
And this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but also something for us to take is that God is in control always. And if you divert from his storyline, he's going to take it back.
Mm-hmm.
Because Ruth, like if Elimelech and his family stayed in Judah, Ruth wouldn't be part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
But who is Ruth? Whose grandmother is she? You know, and so despite... You know, this may not have been what he was supposed to do, but the consequences of it were taken back by God and used for his purpose.
Right. Yeah, so God can use the choices that maybe we shouldn't have made and the situations that erupt from that to accomplish pretty awesome things.
And it doesn't, whatever we think we're changing, we're not changing anything.
Right. He's in control at all times. Right. So Elimelech gathers up his family, and we're not told of the mindset of all of them here. I don't know how much Naomi might have stood up at this point, or if at all, or the children. But Elimelech is the one that is leading, and the decision ultimately rests with him. Notice his decision is not just affecting him, but it's affecting multiple people. And it's affecting multiple people over a period of time. Because they move to Moab, Elimelech dies, we're told. And then do they move back? Now that they have the freedom, perhaps, to make another decision? What do they do, according to verse 3? The remainders, the survivors.
It says that his sons married two Moabite women, which, again, we're not told like the reasoning behind why they stayed there. I mean, Naomi would have been like the maybe de facto leader of the family by then, but that kind of depends on how old her sons were. Maybe if they were still like technically kids or in their teens, she might not have felt comfortable taking just them two and her the whole 30-mile, one-week journey all the way back to Israel by herself.
I hear you. You know, certainly the boys are going to factor into this. They're marriageable age. That kind of gives us some indication of where they are. But you're right. They're kind of having to figure out how to work together and make decisions going forward. And those men are going to be sort of looking out, but they marry women within Moab, and then what? They stay another 10 years. You talk about that theme of assimilation. Well, I mean, that's a long period, really. You know, how long have you been here? Or have you ever been somewhere 10 years straight? You tend to start to assimilate. I'm starting to feel a little more Atlantan than I did 5 years ago. Right? So they're there 10 years and are assimilating. Next big question that comes up is, should the boys have married these ladies? What would be your answer to that?
Not according to Deuteronomy 7:3-4.
Which says what?
We'll have to turn there and read. Deuteronomy 7:3-4 says, furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take your daughters for their sons. For they will turn your eyes, you'll turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and you will quickly destroy you.
Okay.
That's one possibility.
Okay. Yeah, this text is a really interesting one in terms of God's view of marriage with peoples outside the land. I've seen an objection to the use of this text because what peoples are not identified in the list in verse 1? The Moabites are not there. Like, oh, wait a minute. You know, these are the seven nations that are excluded. But where are the Moabites, right? What was God's major concern? Because I think this text does need to be considered. What was God's major concern?
They probably didn't have it like just specifically defined back then, but like there's a specific process for like converting to Judaism if you're like wanting to convert. Like there's some sort of like a loophole exception for like women if they're marrying into a Jewish family, if they're like married by a priest and like convert. And then and also someone like had a theory that like maybe Samuel had like written this in order to like there's something in Talmud saying something about Samuel writing the book of Greek to settle a dispute about Israel, about intermarriage between Moabite women and Israelite men. Like maybe that had been the exception. Like don't like men can't marry in, but women could under like certain things.
Okay, I've seen multiple things related to that as well. There's some detailed questions I don't know quite how to answer yet. In the end, was it fine for Ruth to be married to Boaz? The text seems to imply so. And that marriage was blessed to the point where David emerged from that, right? So in terms of kind of those questions, I mean, one thing that we're going to see is Ruth, I mean, that theme of assimilation is in our conversation here about this marriage, because God's concern was that your heart not be pulled aside to serve the gods of the people into which you marry into. Ruth, ultimately, while the marriage to her first husband was, I think, a problem, her goal by the end of the book is what? To assimilate with Israel, to join the people of God.
And I think it was known that she had done that.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Boaz didn't speak to what she had done. So that even her statement about your God will be my God, I think it was well understood that she's not a danger to pull you toward.
Right. She had abandoned the former culture, whereas Orpah, we're going to see, went back to her people and her gods, in the words of Ruth, right? Ruth had abandoned all of that, right? So there's something to that. But in the book of Ezra, chapter 9 and 10 in particular, Ezra highlights Moabites in particular are mentioned there. In fact, the text in chapter 9, which I just want to read to make it clear. In chapter 9, the leaders come to Ezra in verse 1 and say, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the... And the nations are mentioned, and Moabites are there. And verse 10 says, and now, O our God, as Ezra is praying, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants the prophets, saying, the land which you're entering to possess is unclean. Verse 12, do not give your daughters as wives for their sons, nor take their daughters to your sons. He's quoting, I think, from Deuteronomy 7, and he's making it applicable to, you know, all of these marriages, which include Moabite marriages. The concern, once again, was the turning of the heart. The Moabite women were among the women that are identified in 1 Kings 11 that turned Solomon's heart towards these other gods. So I think we are to understand from the first few verses of Ruth that these marriages were wrong. Yeah, go ahead, Vicki.
I know I might be skipping ahead.
Go ahead. We're already doing that. It's okay.
I also think it's kind of interesting to know, like, yes, you can say that, you know, from these verses, the marriage is wrong. There's also something to be said about kind of the character of these women,
mm-hmm.
especially when later, you know, they're urged to leave, they both leave, mm-hmm. you know, and they both initially say, no, we will go with you. And, you know, they both accept the blessing from, you know, the true God,
mm-hmm.
you know. And while, you know, like, prophets did return, you know, turn around to one another, I think it shows in essence that, yes, it was wrong, but the character of these women may not have been one that was so contentious and one that would have been, you know, pulling away the hearts of the as we later see in Ruth, you know, she turns out to have that really character. You know?
So your point is that there were some good characteristics in these women,
yeah,
right?
While the people were not Jews, that doesn't mean to say that people cannot be, you know, good or have that heart that's, you know, tender
true.
Towards God.
True.
You know,
right.
Without even having known him yet.
Right. And certainly following Ruth to her conclusion, right, is kind of an ultimate example of that. That's good. But that question of assimilation again is there before you, right? I mean, there they are living in the land. Elimelech's brought the family there. You know, these are the people you're living among. These are the women that you're interacting with. These are the draw, if you will, is that, well, I mean, why not these people? Why not? The two sons make that choice. And yet, I think we see from God's law, they ought not to have. I want to take, you know, 3 minutes here, have you talk within, you know, folks on your row or whatever, and I've struggled with how to word the question. I wrote it multiple ways. Can you think of, biblical examples are fine, but more important maybe personal examples, where we're tempted to respond to a problem or to a decision point with kind of the way that everybody else in our world would respond to it versus how God would have us respond to it. That's what happens here with response to the famine, with response to the, hey, here are the marriageable women near me, you know, kind of thing. Can you think of personal examples, you know, where we're tempted to make a decision based on the way kind of everybody normally thinks in our world versus how God would have us to respond to that? Let's talk about it for a couple of minutes. I'm just kind of wondering examples that pop immediately into your mind. We'll share them in a moment.
This one here.
And I think that's a really good decision. Moving people, not of the carrying something out, right? That initial step of the closure of that important. After all, people should judge me on what I wear and all these things that want to tell themselves. But
maybe 30 more seconds.
But it can be the first step. If I dress up these people, then I can remember that they like me better. And I'm acting like them. That, I think, is a really good example of that first step in the kidney situation.
I think we appreciate your possession.
All right, let's share together. And here's what I want to do. I want to kind of do it in rapid fire. I don't want to spend too long on any one kind of situation, even though you might be very passionate about it. And the details are great. Kind of summarize rapid fire. What are some of those things that you guys immediately thought of as situations?
Very.
Well, no, nobody's saying anything. Near one, right?
It's an easy one.
But that's a really common one, right? And a very emotional one, correct? So that same challenge, really, that we're talking about
in wars.
Okay, I mean, kind of going along with that, the challenge to, I mean, the world today says, fine, if you're not compatible, right? And there can be a lot of, not just emotional choices, but temptations due to factors where it's like, well, why? Why would I stay in this? What would God have me to do? Stay in Israel? There's a famine. I'm going to die. Why would God want this? What other situations?
Violence. Whether it's the ability to seize the weapons and your property.
Okay. So, violence in you're thinking self-defense?
Or you place the practice. Like, you think it's okay because it's protecting your ability to have a right. You know, we serve a Lord that told men to put his sword away.
Okay. It's okay to have a gun. Be fun to have more discussion on that one. But there's a question there of, you know, what is right? Well, there's definitely an earthly way of thinking about what's right. But then there's what would God have me to do in those situations? What else?
Talk about clothing.
Clothing.
Dressing.
Oh, okay.
World. And that's more of a moving to Moab kind of assimilation than marrying and settling down. It's the first step, it can be, into other problems.
Okay. You know, I have no idea how Moabites would appear coming into Israel, but certainly the parallel is cultures do have their kind of ways of appearing that communicate things. Dress communicates. So that question of, well, what would God have me wear versus kind of what's normal, you know, is a good one.
You mentioned too that just like material possessions.
Okay.
This thing should be important to me, or even like this career should be important to me. That can cross some lines, and you need to make some decisions, and the world will tell you to make one decision.
This is the next step up. This is what I need to send my kids to school. This is what, I don't know if there's a church there. I think I heard something about that, but this is the next step. Very common.
Yeah, very similarly, when you get a job and it pays really well, to kind of budget for giving instead of being willing to give freely, and kind of taking care of yourself and being really selfish with the money and then giving, that's a very American attitude.
So really, that goes along with material possessions, but kind of more what you choose to do with it kind of thing, right? How you choose to view, I don't know the right way to say it, but that's a great point, because material possessions in our culture, for sure, are a strong temptation for a lot of worldly viewpoints.
I guess in relating to the tolerance movement when it comes to, like, everybody having their own truth, and homosexuality, like, a lot of businesses are under fire for that, or just standing up for that in your workplace, like, you can really be under the gun.
Okay.
When it comes to tolerance.
I'll kind of put that up there as social issues, ungodly viewpoints. We had a study last Tuesday night talking about our culture ingrains, it tries to ingrain within us, you know, this is right, this is wrong, and that can be a very strong, powerful influence, kind of what everybody around you says or thinks. Well, that's not necessarily how God says or thinks things. Anything else? Yeah.
Depending on others and self versus depending on God. So having, instead of having God being your go-to, you're having everyone else and listening to everyone else's advice.
Okay. Right, that kind of often goes with the material possessions. That's a really, really good point. You know, there are times when we're thinking more about the practical than the principle. Times, I like this phrase I saw from some times where we have to choose between godly faith and greener fields. That draw of what looks to be the easy solution, there is food, is not necessarily the right path. Faith, not sight. 2 Corinthians 5:7, right? So kind of that first five verses underscore, kind of set the stage for seeing the redemption out of some bad decisions that were made at the beginning that are experienced by Ruth and Naomi. So we'll stop here. You've got on your schedule the rest of chapter 1 is what we'll look through on this tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.